It's the Kim Munson Show, analyzing the most important stories.
An early childhood taxing district, what on earth is that?
The latest in politics and world affairs.
I don't think that we should be passing legislation that is so complicated that people kind of throw up their hands and say, oh, I can't understand it.
Today's current opinions and ideas.
It is not fair that just because you're a big business that you get a break on this and the little guy doesn't.
Is it freedom or is it force? Let's have a conversation.
Indeed, and Merry Christmas. This is our Christmas Eve broadcast, and I wish a very Merry Christmas to you and yours. This is one of my most favorite days of the year, a very holy day, the day of Christ's birth, that we celebrate Christ's birth. And Merry Christmas to you, Producer Steve.
And Merry Christmas to you as well. Not to belabor the point, but do you believe that it's here?
I cannot believe that it's here. Time is going so quickly. But I wish each and every one of you a Merry Christmas, and each and every one of you on our team, and that's Producer Steve, Zach, Patty, Keith, Charlie, Jen, all the people here at Crawford Broadcasting, a Merry Christmas as well. We've got a really great show planned for you today. I will be talking with Bill Federer in the second, third, and fourth segment about Christmas traditions. And he is always such a fascinating guest. I always learn so much when he's on, Steve.
Well, I would highly, highly encourage anyone listening to stay tuned for this, because you might be sitting back and saying, well, I have my Christmas traditions and I know all about them. And I guarantee you, you don't, in terms of their origins, how many centuries old they are, those types of things. And this is, Federer is the right man to bring this to us.
He's the perfect guest for our Christmas Eve broadcast. And we're also going to be talking with a couple of our great sponsors that bring this show to you. As you know, we're an independent voice. We search for truth and clarity by looking at these issues through this lens of freedom versus force, force versus freedom. So we'll be talking with Steve Kruse with Three Points Financial later on in the show, as well as Hal Van Herkey. And again, another sponsor of both of the shows is Hooters Restaurants. And this next week, as you're thinking about getting together with friends, I actually was over there, had talked to the owner and the owners and the PR person for Hooters Restaurants, and they're keeping the line on their $10 hamburgers. And so that's a great place to go to get together with friends. So be sure and check that out. Steve, we'll be talking about Christmas. I was thinking of Charles Dickens, A Christmas Carol. And so I was looking for Charles Dickens quotes, and I was really shocked to find the one that I found. And Charles Dickens, you know him, he was an English writer and social critic. He created some of the world's best known fictional characters and is regarded by many as the greatest novelist of the Victorian era. His works enjoyed unprecedented popularity during his lifetime. By the 20th century, critics and scholars had recognized him as a literary genius. Remember, he wrote A Christmas Carol. He was born in 1812 and he died in 1870. Steve, this is what he said. And I know this is a little political for Christmas Eve, but yet the fact that Charles Dickens said it, I thought was fascinating. He said, "The American elite is almost beyond redemption. Moral relativism has set in so deeply that the gilded classes have become incapable of discerning right from wrong. Everything can be explained away, especially by journalists. Life is one great moral mush, sophistry washed down with Chardonnay. The ordinary citizens, thank goodness, still adhere to absolutes. It is they who have saved the republic from creeping degradation while their betters were derelict." You could write that for today.
Now, that's an Englishman speaking on the American elite, right?
Mm-hmm.
And let's say he uttered those words in the 1830s or 1840s. Boy, did he nail it. How did he know?
Well, I think that we can take great comfort in knowing that what is happening right now is nothing new. But the veil, as we talk about it all the time, the veil is off on this. And, you know, he wrote A Christmas Carol, and, you know, what a powerful, I mean, it's classic. But yet what he just said here regarding the American elite is, it is what is going on now. Veil is off. I think we really need to celebrate Christmas this season, and then we realize that come 2022, January 1, we have work to do.
But then think about the body or the storyline of A Christmas.
A Christmas Carol?
Yeah, okay.
Uh-huh.
my, oh, where's my mind today? I guess my mind's on Christmas. Wasn't that kind of Scrooge was in the elite, right?
True.
And by the time the story is told, he's no longer exclusively part of that elite, at least not in his mind and in his heart.
In his mind and he was still a successful businessman, but he just looked at things differently. And that's why I think it's such a powerful story regarding Charles Dickens. Any Christmas traditions you want to share with the listeners?
Oh, my. You kind of hit me cold now. Different family. I mean, obviously, my earliest, some of my earliest memories are tied to Christmas. So family, that's just the tradition right there.
Well, and we've started a new one. If in town, I normally am doing an Italian Christmas dinner. And I have got a great spaghetti recipe.
What time should we be there?
I'll get back with you on that, okay? And no, you'd always be welcome. And then also, we put out, our neighbor really has this tradition of luminarias. And it is so beautiful. And I also love that on Christmas Eve.
Luminaria, those are the ones on the ground. Uh-huh. There's this other thing about this thing that takes the heat of the flame and basically creates a small balloon. And it goes up in the air, but I always wonder about those. Aren't you concerned about where they come down?
Boy, and this, with as dry as it is, I surely would think so. So for sure. But anyway, let's continue on. We'll be talking with Bill Fetter in just a minute. But I have so many great partners that I get to work with. And one of those great partners is Three Points Financial. On the line with us is Steve Cruz. He is one of the owners of Three Points Financial. And this is our Christmas Eve broadcast. Merry Christmas to you, Steve, and your family.
Thanks, Kim, and you too. Merry Christmas and happy holidays to you and to all your listeners too.
Well, and so what would you like to share with our listeners? We're looking at 2022 right around the corner, and on this Christmas Eve, what would you like them to know?
Yeah, it's usually, as we're approaching a new year, usually it's a good time. You know, people are evaluating New Year's resolutions and all that kind of thing, and it's a good time to get financially organized. And so part of this is getting just rid of stuff you no longer need. For example, you know, keeping your tax returns forever, but you can get rid of the supporting documentation after 7 years. And I know a lot of people kind of have some pretty thick tax folders that they keep around for a while. So that's an example of something to get rid of. And we do have a checklist that people can look through in how long to keep things and what to get rid of. And if anybody wants that checklist, the email is steve@threepointsfinancial.com. Another part of getting organized is just putting together an inventory of financial accounts or products, you know, bank accounts, CDs, life insurance, saving bonds, annuities, home equity, pensions, social securities. There's so much that most people really never actually get all that in one place. So just take an inventory of all that. And again, we have a checklist that we can provide people if they want that. And the problem is financial decisions made without looking at full financial picture are rarely the best financial decisions. And many times new clients tell us after we've helped them through this process, that it's the first time that they've actually seen everything in one place. Most of the time people go to an insurance agent to talk about insurance, a CPA to talk about taxes, an investment advisor to talk about investments, and they never see it all in one place. And at Three Points Financial, that's what we do. We bring together the full picture of our clients' goals, their financial picture under one roof. A lot of people are going to be watching football probably over the next couple of weeks. So we kind of act as a head coach of a football team. You know, we coordinate all the various players into plays aimed to win the game. And, winning, in this sense of the word, all depends on, you know, what's important to our clients.
Well, and that makes so much sense. And for people to get that checklist, they go to your website. Is that right?
Yeah, they can just shoot me an email, steve@threepointsfinancial.com, and I'd be happy to send that checklist to them.
Okay, fantastic. That's Steve, that's Steve, @threepointsfinancial.com. And Steve Cruz, we will talk to you next week on New Year's Eve. I cannot believe how fast time is going, and Merry Christmas.
All right, thanks. Look forward to it, Kim.
And we'll be right back with Bill Fetterer.
Would you have ever dreamed that freedom of speech, freedom of thought, freedom of assembly, and freedom of religion would be under assault and attack in America? Unbelievably, it is happening right before our eyes. That is why it is important to keep free-thinking, independent voices on the airwaves, the internet, and social media. Kim Munson is one of those important voices. Help her keep independence alive. Go to KimMunson.com to contribute to join Kim in the battle of ideas raging in America today. That's Kim Munson, MONSON.com.
And welcome back to the Kim Munson Show. Be sure and check out our website. That is Kim Munson, MONSON.com. Sign up for our weekly newsletter there. And you can email me at Kim@KimMunson.com as well. This is such a special broadcast. This is our Christmas Eve broadcast. And I am so excited to have our guest, William Federer. He is the host of the American Minute. He is a writer, an author, a speaker. And we're going to be talking about traditions of Santa Claus, or of Christmas. And his book is There Really Is a Santa Claus, History of St. Nicholas and Christmas Holiday Traditions. Bill Federer, welcome to the show.
Kim, great to be with you.
And a Merry Christmas to you.
Yes, yes, Merry Christmas.
Let's talk about this. Where does this all begin, all of these traditions? Where should we start?
Well, first is the date, and people say, well, it was December 25th, really, the date of Christmas. Well, it's interesting. The Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered, and there was an item in there that answered a lot of questions, and it was the King David was the one who had the Levite priests break into 24 groups, and each family group took a week taking care of the temple twice a year. They were called courses, and they weren't sure when they began and when they ended, but then the Dead Sea Scrolls and then also the records of it gives the order of these courses of these families, but there still was a question as to when they started. And when the Temple of Jerusalem was destroyed by the Romans, the Josephus did keep track of what course was there on duty when the temple was destroyed. And so that gives us the we can piece together when all the other ones are. Why is that significant? The book of Luke says that John the Baptist's dad, Zechariah, was of the course of Abijah. And so we know that that was like the eighth family group. And it was the one that was on duty for Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, which is at the end of September. And then he goes, and the angel says, you're going to have a son, John the Baptist. He doesn't believe him. He's struck dumb. And then he goes and visits his wife, and then she conceives. And then we go over to Mary in the Gospel of Luke, and the angel appears to her, and she says, I'm the handmaid of the Lord, and she conceives by the Holy Spirit. And then the angel says, and your cousin Elizabeth is in her sixth month. And so if we know that Zechariah was in the temple at the end of September, and then he goes with his wife, and then 6 months later would be the end of March. And so the end of March would be when Mary conceived, and 9 months after March, the end of March is the end of December.
Oh, my gosh. That is so fascinating.
Yeah, it's one of these, like, you know, mystery puzzle pieces that you piece together. And but anyway, so the Jews really didn't pay attention to birth dates that much. It's an Asian, like, you know, people that I know, some friends in Turkey, and we asked them when the one woman's birthday was, and she went in the other room and she came back with her, you know, driver's license. She looks at it and she goes, "Oh, this." I mean, she didn't even have it memorized. And then we talked to people in Korea, and everybody in Korea, like, is a year older on January 1st. People really don't keep up with the actual date that they were born. It was a Western Greek thing. And so it wasn't until a couple centuries after Jesus that the Greeks were converting in large numbers, and they began to wonder, you know, when was he born? The early church's big concern was the date of the resurrection and the date of Passover. And so there was a whole lot of the first three centuries of nailing that date down. But it was only later. Anyway, so picking up with that, the first three centuries, there are 10 major persecutions. Christians are thrown to the lions, and we zero in on Asia Minor. Today, that's Turkey. And there was the Christian experience was small group, and you would often get persecuted by the government. I know it's hard for us to imagine the government would persecute people of faith. And so in Asia Minor, there was a town called Patara, and there was a wealthy family who had a son named Nicholas, and the parents died, and Nicholas inherits the wealth. And he decides to be a Christian, but this movement that swept through called Pietism, and it was, if you're really Christian, you'll give away your money to the poor, and you'll spend the rest of your life in a cave as a hermit, or you'll join a monastery and take vows of silence. And anyway, so Nicholas decides he's a Christian, and so he's going to give away his money, but he doesn't want to get the credit for it, so he wants to go into town at nighttime and throw money in the window of poor people. And that way, you know, they'd only give the credit to God. Well, a famous story, and there's lots of artwork on old churches with mosaics, with stained glass windows, of Nicholas on his tippy toes throwing money in the window, and then inside is a man with three daughters. And so the story is that this merchant had gone bankrupt, and the creditors were going to come and not only take your house and lands, they were going to take your children, his daughters. And he knew if they were taken, it would be a terrible life of prostitution. Unfortunately, there still is sex trafficking today. And so the father had an idea. If he could hurry up and marry his daughters off, the creditors couldn't take him. Unfortunately, he did not have money for a dowry, which was needed in that area of the world for a legally recognized wedding. Well, Nicholas hears the problem late one night, throws some money in the window. It's a dowry for the oldest daughter. She gets married. It's the big buzz, talk of the town. Then he does it the next night, or another night, for the second daughter. She gets married. And when he throws the money in for the third daughter, by this time the dad's expecting him. He's waiting up. He runs outside, catches Nicholas, and Nicholas makes the father promise not to tell where the money came from because he wants the credit to go to God and not to him. And so this is the origin of the tradition of secret gift giving on the anniversary of Nicholas's death, which is December 6th of 343 A.D. And now the story is that after he gives away all of his money, he does go to the Holy Land, and he's going to join a monastery. And but somehow the Lord tells him not to hide his light under a bushel. And then he goes back to Asia Minor and gets off at a big port city called Myra, M-Y-R-A. And unbeknownst to him, the bishop had died. And the church leaders could not decide who the next bishop was going to be. And one of them is an older man. He prays, and he has a dream that the first person in the church the next day would be named Nicholas, and he was to be their next bishop. Well, Nicholas's habit was to fast all night and not have breakfast until after church, right? So they would fast, and then after church they would break the fast. So they would call it breakfast. Breakfast.
Wow.
And So he was the first one to church. The old man asked him his name. He says, Nicholas, just follow me. Take him to the back room. And they say, you're supposed to be our bishop. Well, he was not too excited about that because the Roman Emperor Diocletian was arresting bishops and killing them. So it was sort of like, you be the bishop. No, no, I insist, you first. No, no, really, you be the bishop, you know. And, well, he agrees, and sure enough, he is arrested, and he's put in jail, and he's awaiting death. And then we go back to what was going on in the world. So you had a Roman emperor named Diocletian, and this is he takes power around 285 AD, and he lost some battles with Persia. He asks his generals why. The general said, it's your fault because you've neglected having the Roman army worship the Roman gods. And so Diocletian says, okay, everybody in the military, get back to worshiping the Roman gods. Well, there's a lot of Christians in the military because this is the 3rd century A.D., and the previous emperor had been sort of lax. They could not return to worshiping the Roman God, so they're forced out. Once all the Christians have been purged from the military, Diocletian decides to use the military to force the entire Roman Empire to return to worshiping the Roman gods. And he goes province by province, arresting pastors, tearing down churches, burning the scriptures, boiling them alive, It goes on for 10 years, and the Christians cry out in prayer, and suddenly Diocletian is struck with an intestinal disease, so painful he abdicates the throne on May 1st, 305 AD. And I think it's sort of, you know, funny because the emperors at this time had been declaring themselves a god, sprinkling gold dust in their hair and demanding that their image be worshipped. So this was sort of like a god resigning. And but the next emperor was Galerius. He continues the persecution. He's struck with an intestinal disease and dies. And now it's a toss-up between the biggest generals. There's four generals, and each one claims to be the emperor, and they fight it out. And it comes down to two of them, Constantine, who's in York, England, and his men surround him and say, "Hail Caesar." And so he's marching toward Rome. And then in Rome, you have Maxentius. And in 312 AD is the Battle of the Milvian Bridge. And supposedly the day before the battle, Constantine sees the sign of Christ in the sky, puts it on all of his shields and symbols, and he wins. And then he stops the persecution of Christians. Now, the sign of Christ, the tradition is that it's the first two Greek letters of the name Christ. So Hebrew, the word is Messiah or the anointed one, but in Greek, it's Christ. And the Greek letter that makes the ka sound is written as an X, and it's called the chi. And the Greek letter that makes the ur sound is called the rho, and it's written as a big P. So if the big X and a P is the first two letters of the Greek name for Christ, and they'd put on all these shields and symbols. Over the centuries, it got shortened just to the X. It was called the chi or the Christ's cross. And it was a form of a written oath where you'd sign on documents and you'd sign at the Christ cross that you were going to keep your word. And so that comes has come down to us as sign at the X. And then they would kiss it to show sincerity. And so that came down as the X's and the O's on the bottom of the Valentine. I'm going to keep my promise to you, you know, in front of Christ. And then, or cross my heart, swear to tell the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And but anyway, so Constantine legalizes Christianity in 313 AD, and so Nicholas is let out of jail. And he goes back to Myra, and he, now that it's okay to be Christian, he preaches against paganism. And nearby is the temple to Diana at Ephesus. It's one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. This enormous temple, 127 huge pillars, and temple prostitutes. It was the Las Vegas of the Mediterranean. Yeah, you're going to go to the temple, huh? We know what you're going to do. And so Nicholas and the Apostle Paul preached against Diana worship in Acts chapter 19, you know, there at Ephesus. And but anyway, Nicholas preaches against it so much that people tear the temple to Diana down.
Oh,
so
boy.
He was a real fire and brimstone preacher. And then there is the Arian heresy. A guy named Arius said that Jesus was a little less than God, a created being, and it began to spread and split the church. The Visigoths, who were people that came into Rome, converted en masse to Arianism. And Constantine's like, "Look, Christians, I legalize you guys, and now you're fighting doctrinally, and it's having a political fallout on my kingdom. Settle it." So Constantine pays for all the bishops to go to one city called Nicaea. It's the first time that all the Christian leaders are together in one place. And they settle it with the Nicene Creed. And the tradition is that Nicholas was so upset at Arius for starting the Arian heresy that he slapped him across the face on the floor of the conference. So jolly old Saint Nick had a little temper.
I guess so.
I'd better watch out if he's coming to town. I was doing a Google search because I have a PowerPoint when I talk and looking for, you know, the mosaic, you know, pick, you know, icons of Nicholas, and there was one that somebody put on the bottom. It says, "I came to give presents to children and to slap heretics. I just ran out of presents."
That's great. That is great.
Anyway, so then there's a corrupt governor who is about to execute some soldiers to cover up his corruption, and Nicholas has a dream of what happened, and he goes down to the execution ground and breaks through the crowd, grabs the sword out of the executioner's hand, and then in front of everybody tells all the details of the corrupt stuff the governor was doing. Governor knows nobody could know all these details other than God, and so he begs Nicholas to pray for him. And the Greeks have lots of stories. He's considered the patron saint of pawnbrokers. You're like, what? Yeah, pawnbrokers say that they help people out in their time of financial need. And just like Nicholas did with those three bags of gold for those three daughters. And so the pawn shops would hang a thing in front of their shop with three gold balls dangling from it. You may have, you know, recognized that little symbol that pawnbrokers put out there. But then there was a since Myra's a port city, and there was a famine, and the ships coming from North Africa with grain headed toward Rome, Nicholas goes down, talks him into unloading some grain to feed his people, and they do, and he promises God will bless him. And on their return trip, they said the grain that was left had multiplied, and they had more than enough, sort of like the Elijah and the little widow's meal barrel. And then there was a storm, and the fishermen and sailors couldn't get back. He goes down and prays. The sea becomes calm, sort of like Jesus calmed the sea. And so there's lots of stories the Greeks have. Some are more believable than others. And but he dies in 343 A.D. on December 6th. And so these Greeks would leave presents for each other. Justinian, and if we have to go to a break, just let me know.
Yeah, you know what? Let's do that, because this is so interesting. I'm talking with Bill Federer. This is our Christmas Eve broadcast. He's written a book, There Really Is a Santa Claus, History of St. Nicholas and Christmas Holiday Traditions. I've learned so much, but we're going to go to break. Before we do that, though, the show comes to you because I have such great sponsors. One of them is Kirsch Insurance Group, and they are specialists in the Medicare arena. And as we're looking into 2022, there will be some things going on with Medicare. You want to sell... set yourself up for success. And so be sure and reach out to Kirsch Insurance Group. That is iKirsch, K-I-R-S-C-H.com, iKirsch.com. We'll be right back with Bill Federer.
Life is more than what we have in the bank. Mary Alpers and Steve Kruse with Three Points Financial understand that comprehensive financial planning is an important component for each individual to thrive and prosper. Three Points Financial provides tax, investment, and retirement planning so that you can achieve your financial independence. With so much public policy uncertainty, it is important to have the professionals at Three Points Financial working for you to navigate those uncharted waters. Check out ThreePointsFinancial.com to schedule your initial consultation to achieve your financial freedom. That's ThreePointsFinancial.com.
Home ownership and private property rights help you build wealth for you and your family. RE/MAX Alliance award-winning realtor Karen Levine understands this. Supply is super tight right now. This is why you need a seasoned professional with excellent negotiating skills on your side of the table, whether buying or selling an existing home or buying a new build. As a member of the National Association of Realtors Board of Directors, Karen Levine volunteers hours of her time to help you build your American dream. Call her today at 303-877-7516. Again, that's 303-877-7516.
You'd like to get in touch with one of Kim Munson's sponsors, but you can't recall their phone number. Find a full list of advertising partners on Kim's website, kimmunson.com. That's Kim, M-O-N-S-O-N.com.
And welcome back to the Kim Munson Show, and this is our Christmas Eve broadcast, a very special broadcast. On the line with me is Bill Federer, and he is talking about traditions. He's written a book about this, which would be a great book to just have on hand, and it is There Really Is a Santa Claus, History of St. Nicholas and Christmas Holiday Traditions. So this whole St. Nicholas story is just really kind of the bedrock of a lot of our traditions, correct, Bill?
Yes. So he was a big deal, and Justinian, who was the Christian emperor of the Byzantine Empire, he built a cathedral in Myra. Today it's called Demre, and that was around 527 A.D. And then Vladimir the Great of Russia. He is the one who threw all the pagan Russian gods in the Dnieper River, and he's going to embrace monotheism. And the Jews sent some representatives, and they were called Khazars. And he said, well, you offended your God and got kicked out of Jerusalem. I don't want to follow you. And then the Muslims sent representatives. And the First Chronicle of Russia said, Vladimir listened intently when the Muslims told him that paradise was filled full of virgins because he was fond of women. But then when they told him he could not drink alcohol, he said, we cannot have this because drink is the joy of the Russes, the Russians. So I think it's funny that Russia didn't convert to Islam because Vladimir liked to drink. Catholics sent representatives, but it was the Greek Orthodox that showed up. And they said, look, we speak Greek, the language of the New Testament. Our land is where John spoke and Paul spoke. And then some ambassadors had gone down to the Hagia Sophia this enormous cathedral in Constantinople, 165 feet high, 102 foot across dome. They said it was like walking into heaven. So Vladimir converts to the Eastern Orthodox Christianity, and he adopts Nicholas as the patron saint of Russia. That was in the year 988 A.D. And so that's why just about every town in Russia had a Nicholas, St. Nicholas Church, or they had emperors named Nikolai or whatever. But then the Muslims invade. And they, 1087, they're going through destroying churches and libraries and museums and artworks. All seven churches mentioned in the book of Revelation were wiped out by the Muslim Turks. And so the Christians don't want the grave of St. Genevieve trashed. And so in 1087, they move his bones over to Italy, a little town called Bari, B-A-R-I, and the Pope Urban II dedicates the church there for him. And that same Pope Urban II had so many Greeks flooding over with all these horror stories that he went to the Consul of Clermont in 1095 and begged the kings of Europe to send help. And they did. It's called the First Crusade. So the same Pope that welcomed Nicholas's remains to Western Europe is the one who called for the First Crusade. There were nine major crusades. But sort of interesting, even the years ago, in like 2009, the Turkish Minister of Tourism told reporters that they were wanting to demand that the bones of Nicholas be returned. They didn't do that. So now that his story is in Western Europe, it catches on, and the gift-giving becomes really popular, so much so that St. Francis of Assisi, sort of in protest, came up with a nativity scene in 1223 A.D., saying, look, all the gift-giving's fine, but we need to get back to the real reason for the season. Jesus was born in a manger. And then, so whenever you see a nativity scene, that goes back to the 1200s with St. Francis of Assisi. And then we have the Reformation, 1517, Martin Luther. And by this time, there's a saint's day for every day of the year. Matter of fact, there's like a dozen saints for every day of the year. And the cathedrals are filled full of statues and relics and all kinds of things. And he considered this a distraction from Christ. And so he cleans out the churches and ends all the saints' days. But the Germans really liked the St. Nicholas Day and all the gift-giving. And so he moved all the gift-giving from December 6th to December 25th and said all gifts come from the Christ child. And the German pronunciation of Christ child was Christkindl, like kindergarten, kindercare, right, means child. And over the years, Christkindl got pronounced Kris Kringle.
Huh.
So Kris Kringle is really Christkindl, which means Christ child.
Okay.
And that goes back to Martin Luther. And he also came back at night and saw the sky twinkling with stars, and he put candles in the branches of the tree in their house and said this is like the sky above Bethlehem on the night of Christ's birth.
And how did that work out, though, on that, Bill, candles on trees back then? Were there a lot of fires?
I'm sure there were. But, but it is interesting, the tree. So you know how St. Patrick was really from Britain, a Roman colony, and he evangelized Ireland, those Druids, and they were all illiterate Druids. And so when they converted, he was trying to convey spiritual principles. So he used a three-leaf clover to teach the Trinity, Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, three in one. Well, in the 700s is another guy from Britain named St. Boniface or Winfrid, and he goes to evangelize these Germanic pagan tribes. Again, the year 722 A.D., and, you know, this is Muslims are still invading Spain at this time. But Winfrid goes through all these, you know, deep forests, and he finally gets to where these Germanic tribes are. And they worship Thor, who lives in a big oak tree. And they're going to what's where we get Thor's Day, Thursday. And then they worship another Germanic god named Woden. And that's where we get the word Wednesday. And but these are pagan gods, and so Saint Boniface takes an axe and chops down Thor's tree.
Ooh, that is that a problem?
And people are like, people are like, well, I'd kill him for doing it. And then somebody said, well, if Thor's really a god, he can protect his own tree. And so Saint Boniface sort of did the same thing that Saint Patrick did. He looked for something in nature to convey spirit, and so the evergreen tree sort of is in the shape of a triangle, right? Two sides in the bottom, and so the Father, Son, the Holy Ghost, and then it always is green. So he said this is like everlasting life, and it points toward heaven. And so a guy named Henry Van Dyke in 1906 wrote sort of a poem. It's called The First Christmas Tree, and he says, "The day before Christmas in the year of our Lord, 722, not a drop of blood shall fall tonight, for this is the birth night of Christ, Son of the All-Father, Savior of the world. This little tree," pointing at the evergreen, "a young child of the forest, shall be your home tree tonight. It is the wood of peace, for your houses are built of fir. It is the sign of endless life, for its branches are evergreen, points toward heaven. Let it be called the tree of the Christ child." And so in one of those towns in Germany, it actually has a statue of St. Boniface standing atop the big stump of a tree with holding an axe in his hand and then a church in the other hand, showing that, you know, yes, he chopped it down. Lights possibly could come from Hanukkah, because when they purged the temple of all the pagan stuff in 365 B.C., so everywhere there were Jews, they would light candles at this time of the year. So maybe that's where that came from. But the big change came in England. And so just like Martin Luther brings the Reformation to Germany, Henry VIII brings the Reformation to England. But he does it not because of a spiritual reason. He just wanted another wife. And he was married to the Catholic daughter of the King of Spain, but she doesn't have a son. So he decides to divorce her. The Pope won't recognize the divorce. So Henry decides in 1534 to make himself his own Pope. He starts the Church of England, puts himself on as the head, and he goes on to have six wives, divorced, beheaded, died, divorced, beheaded, survived. So he's not a really good guy to be married to. A group that started that wanted to purify the church, so they were nicknamed Puritans, and they were really strict. Anyway, Henry VIII, he gets rid of all the saints' days, and he moves all the gift-giving to December 25th. But he, instead of the Christ child, he brings back an old Roman holiday, Saturnalia, because Britain used to be a Roman colony, right? 45 B.C. is when Julius Caesar invaded. And so the Romans had this, you know, week at the end of the year where they would have partying. And so it was more of a drinking, partying type of celebration, very similar to Mardi Gras. So Mardi Gras was actually a spiritual day. It was the day before Lent when you would fast 40 days before Easter, but now it's this lewd party in New Orleans. That's sort of what happened with Christmas under Henry VIII. It was drinking, partying, you know, carousing, chasing women. And the Puritan says, can God be honored by mad mirth and hard drinking and, you know, a party fit for a Bacchus or a Mohammedan Ramadan? And so the Puritans didn't like Christmas. Matter of fact, the Puritans were so strict, they tore down Shakespeare's theater.
Ooh.
The Globe Theater was torn down by the Puritans because they didn't want him saying God in his plays. And so that's when Shakespeare had started to write the, you know, Midsummer Night's Dream, where you got little fairies and everything. Henry VIII, it was, again, during this time that he brings back the pagan stuff, the Roman Saturnalia. And if you ever saw the Christmas Carol with Charles Dickens, there's the spirit of Christmas present.
Right.
And he's a big guy with a wreath in his hair, goblet of wine, grapes all around, sort of a ho-ho happy party guy. And you're looking at him scratching your head, saying he sort of looks like Santa Claus, but he also sort of looks like some Roman god. Well, that's who he was. He was, you know, they Christianized him, called him Father Christmas. But they couldn't call him St. Nicholas because saints were sort of outlawed, right, after the Reformation. And so when the Puritans took over England for 15 years, they outlawed Christmas. And that's about the time that the pilgrims and the Puritans came to America. So the first boatload of pilgrims to America, the very first Christmas, December 25th, 1620, the captain of the Mayflower, Christopher Jones, writes in his ship's log, "At anchor in Plymouth Harbor, Christmas Day, but not observed by these colonists, they being opposed to All Saints' Days, etc. Large party went ashore, fell timber, began to erect their first building." And William Bradford, the governor of the Pilgrims, writes that in 1621, a second boatload of pilgrims came over. And he says, "One more incident, rather amusing. On Christmas Day, the governor called the people out to work as usual, but most of the new company excused themselves and said it was against their conscience to work on that day. So the governor told them if they made it a matter of conscience, he would spare them till they were better informed, because they thought that the Sabbath is the holy day and all the rest of the days are the same. But on returning at noon, he found them playing in the street with pitching the bar and summit stool ball and other such sports. And so he took their games away and said that it was against his conscience that they would work while the others played. So if they're going to make celebrating Christmas a day of devotion, do it quietly in your house. But the Dutch. So most of our Christmas traditions come to us through the Dutch.
Okay, let's stop right there and go to break, Bill Fetter. We're talking about Christmas traditions and just really fascinating. It's great to understand that and so appropriate for our Christmas Eve broadcast. And the show comes to you because I have a lot of really, really great partners. And on the line with me is another one of our great partners, and that is Hal Van Herke with Castlegate Knife and Tool. And for this Christmas Eve broadcast, Merry Christmas, Hal, to you, Linnea, and all those at Castlegate Knife and Tool, and to your family.
Thank you, Kim. Merry Christmas to you, and thank you for the gifts that you gave us, the bottle of wine and the book that I'm looking forward to read. So I appreciate that very much.
Well, and that book is, I just thought it was so appropriate because of your sponsorship of America's Veteran Stories. And that is a book from the Center of American Values down in Pueblo, where they have the Medal of Honor Gallery. And that is quotes from many of our Medal of Honor recipients. And I thought during this time, I think that's just so grounding. These guys that did, and I think there's one woman that received the Medal of Honor, but these guys, what they did, saving other Americans' lives, I thought it's just powerful. So I thought it was so appropriate for you because, Hal, you are a veteran. You offer discounts to our veterans, our military, first responders at Castlegate Knife and Tool, and it just seemed so appropriate. So I'm pleased that you're glad to have it.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, thank you, Kim. And by the way, yes, there was one woman that won the Medal of Honor. She was an Army nurse during the Civil War, and I could tell that story someday. That's the only woman who's won the Medal of Honor. And there will be a lot more in the future. I just wanted to say thank you. We appreciate participating in all of the work that you do and want to wish everybody a Merry Christmas. In terms of our store, we're open today until noon. For people who have last-minute shopping, and then we close up to let everybody get to be with their families. I know at least in my family, Christmas Eve is as big as Christmas Day, and that we really look forward to some of the traditions that we carry on now into the third generation of having the same traditions on Christmas Eve, and hope everybody has the same type of family that they can go to. And if you're out there and you don't have a family to go to, find some friends or reach out and make sure that you're taking care of yourself over the holidays.
Well, that's for sure. And actually, if you're not getting together with friends, it's a great time for reflection, for Bible reading, for reading our great books. And so there's ways to take care of yourself that way as well. So, Hal Van Herke, I so appreciate you, Linnea, and as I mentioned, everybody at Castlegate and your family. So I wish all of you a very Merry Christmas. Your website is castlegate.com. That's castlegate.com. And we will talk to you next week.
Thank you, and Merry Christmas to you and all of yours.
With the federal government printing money, it looks like inflation is on the horizon. That is why you should lock in a low rate now on your mortgage. Lauren Levy with Polygon Financial Group is here to help. Lauren works with a variety of lenders to assist you in finding the mortgage that is just right for you. Locking in a low rate now will save you thousands of dollars over the life of your loan. Don't procrastinate. Don't wait any longer. Call Lauren today at 303-880-8881. That's 303-880-8881.
All of Kim's sponsors are an inclusive partnership with Kim and are not affiliated with or in partnership with KLZ or Crawford Broadcasting. If you would like to support the work of the Kim Munson Show and grow your business, contact Kim at her website, kimmunson.com. That's Kim Munson, MONSON.com.
America's Veteran Stories with Kim Munson, Sunday afternoons at 3, here on KLZ 560 AM and KLZ 100.7.
And welcome back to the Kim Munson Show. Be sure and check out our website. That is Kim Munson, M-O-N-S-O-N.com. Sign up for our weekly newsletter there, and you can email me at kim@kimmunson.com as well. And have just a really great Christmas Eve broadcast here. And this is brought to you because I have a lot of great partners. Another one of them is Hooters Restaurants, and they have five locations. That's Loveland, Westminster, Aurora, Lone Tree, and Colorado Springs. And they have all kinds of happy hour specials and lunch specials to get together with friends during this great Christmas season. On the line with us is Bill Federer, and he is an author, a speaker. He's written a number of books. We're talking about his book, There Really Is a Santa Claus, The History of St. Nicholas and Christmas Holiday Traditions. And Bill, before we went to break, you said that we get a lot of our traditions from the Dutch. How so?
Well, it's interesting that St. Nicholas is the most popular Greek Orthodox saint. He is to the Greek Orthodox what St. Peter is to Roman Catholics. And if you have ever heard the saying, you know, St. Peter's at the gates of heaven, you know, the
right.
Catholic thing. Well, the Greeks do a take on the book of Revelation, where it says Jesus will return at the end of the world to judge the living and the dead, riding a white horse. And the saints will come back with him riding white horses. And St. Nicholas is one of the saints, so he'll be one of those riding a white horse. But he's so important to the Greeks and then the Dutch that he gets to come back once a year for a little mini judgment, a little checkup on the kids, see who's naughty, see who's nice. And the saints come from where? Well, heaven, the celestial city, the New Jerusalem. Well, that turns into the North Pole. And the angels turn into the elves, and the Lamb's Book of Life turns into the Book of the Naughty and the Nice. And you begin to see these different themes, change over the years. So the Dutch, even to this day, have St. Nicholas coming once a year, riding a white horse, dressed as a bishop. And he has with him a little Moorish costumed helper, Zwarte Piet, Black Peter, and he's a Muslim. And they tell the kids, by the way, the Muslims invaded Spain in the year 710 AD and brought about a million Europeans into Islamic slavery. So slavery didn't start in 1619, right? So there were whole Catholic orders throughout Europe in the Middle Ages called the Trinitarians, and they would collect alms and donations to ransom your friend back who was captured from a Greek island or Spanish coast. Miguel de Cervantes was one of those that was rescued back, and he wrote Man of La Mancha. And anyway, so the Dutch will tell the kids, if you're good, St. Nicholas will give you a present. If you're naughty, Zwarte Piet will put you in a gunny sack, take you back to Spain, and sell you into Muslim slavery.
Oh, my gosh.
So often these little Dutch kids, when you tell them Sinterklaas, which is their way of saying Saint Nicholas, when you tell them that Santa Claus is coming, they'd start crying because it might be their last night with the family. You know, I have 11 brothers and sisters. I have five young brothers. I would have loved to have tormented my little brothers. Hey, Santa Claus is coming. Might not see you tomorrow. You know, it's been good, you know. And anyway, I was doing a call-in radio show, and a guy calls in and goes, yeah, I was raised in Holland, and our neighborhood, all the little boys would go to sleep at night with pocket knives in their pockets the night before St. Nicholas visited. I said, why is that? He goes, that's to cut ourselves out of the gunny sack in case we got taken. So it was a real terror. Anyway, so the Dutch settled New Amsterdam, and that turns into New York, and they have their very first Dutch Reformed Church is called St. Nicholas Dutch Reformed Church. So St. Nicholas is sort of like the patron saint of the Dutch. Why? Well, the Dutch in the 1600s had the largest merchant military empire on the planet. They had the Dutch East India Company. They had an island off the coast of Japan. They had Jakarta, Indonesia. They had nutmeg and spices. They had Goa, India. They had South Africa. They had, you know, the Dutch West Indies. They had a global empire, and they had, ships. And they would even have, you know, how they would put a mermaid on the front of a
right.
ship, you know, or a Poseidon. Well, they would have a St. Nicholas on the front of the ship. And so they have their very first church in New York, founded in 1642. It was the St. Nicholas Dutch Reformed Church on Battery, New York City. And over the years, the church grew, and it became the largest Protestant church in the country. It was this big cathedral at 48th and Street and Fifth Avenue in downtown New York City, right? Fifth Avenue. And then it was so big that Teddy Roosevelt used to go to that church, and Norman Vincent Peale, you know, and so forth. So as the centuries went on, or the decades, New York became a financial district, and the residential houses disappeared, and that big church, as beautiful as it was, had fewer and fewer people going to it. And then Sinclair Oil Company came up and said, we would like to buy this corner. And they bought it and tore the church down. Oh. And then the church moved out and built something called Marble Collegiate Church. But anyway, this church, the St. Nicholas Dutch Reformed Church, was a really big church. There's an enormous cathedral in Amsterdam named after St. Nicholas. So in New York, you have an author named Washington Irving. He wrote Rip Van Winkle, Legend of Sleepy Hollow, and Dietrich Knickerbocker's History of New York from the Beginning of the New World to the End of the Dutch Dynasty. And he's the one who came up with the word Gotham, like Gotham City, to describe New York. And so he writes this book, and in there he talks about St. Nicholas visiting once a year, right? Because he visits over there in Holland, so he's visiting this Dutch colony. And Washington Irving writes, St. Nicholas rode over the housetops, drawing forth magnificent presents, dropping them down the chimneys of his favorites. Now he visits us but one night a year and rattles down the chimney, confines his presents merely to children, stockings found mysteriously filled. And but he describes St. Nicholas not dressed as a bishop, keeps the same color, but he's got him in a typical Dutch outfit of a stocking hat, long trunk hose, a large pipe, boots. And then he says, laying his finger beside his nose, gave a significant look, mounting his wagons over the treetops, he rose and then disappeared. So in 1823, there's Clement Moore. And his family donated the land for the Anglican church and seminary there in New York. And there is a Clement Moore Park in New York City at the corner of 10th Avenue and 22nd Street. And they helped establish the Trinity Church there on Hudson Streets. And so Clement Moore writes a poem for his children. And it's titled, 'Twas a Visit from St. Nicholas. So it's night before Christmas, and all through the house, not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. The stockings were hung by the chimney with care in hopes that St. Nicholas would soon be there.
Okay.
When what to my wondering eyes should appear but a miniature sleigh and a tiny reindeer, when a little old driver so lively and quick, I knew in a moment it must be St. Nick. And then it says, so up to the housetop the coursers they flew with a sleigh full of toys and St. Nicholas too. And I drew in my head and was turning around down the chimney. St. Nicholas came with a bound. You get the picture.
Uh-huh.
But he's changed in size. So now he's a chubby, plump, right, jolly old elf. I laughed when I saw him in spite of myself. And so he's shrunk, but he's still St. Nicholas. And then we have the 1843 with Charles Dickens, and he publishes A Christmas Carol with Scrooge and Tiny Tim. And this becomes a bestseller. And the focus on the giving. But then Harper's Weekly magazine in America has an illustrator named Thomas Nast. He is famous for creating the Republican elephant and the Democrat mule. And so Thomas Nast does, during the Civil War, an illustration on the cover of St. Nicholas addressing the Union troops. And it was actually a political jab at the South to say St. Nicholas is associated with the North, and in the background is a North Pole sign. And then you have the 1900s. Haddon Sundblom is an artist for Coca-Cola. He's the one who created the Quaker Oats Man and Aunt Jemima syrup. Anyway, in 1930, he does, for the next 33 years, a painting of Santa Claus, which is the Dutch pronunciation of St. Nicholas. For 33 years, he does a painting of Santa Claus drinking Coke. And Coca-Cola invented mass marketing. It's the best trademark name in the world. And so now this full-grown image, a nice grandfather, huggable, rosy cheeks, is the one that spread around the world. But it all started with a real person who was a Christian who loved Jesus so much so that he gave away all his money, went into the ministry, became a bishop, was imprisoned for his faith, stood up for the doctrine of the Trinity and maybe slapped Arius, is preached against the immorality of the pagan Greek temples, confronted corrupt politicians, but most of all, Nicholas is remembered for anonymously helping the poor in their time of need. And so just a fascinating story that we can remember and celebrate on this wonderful Christmas Eve.
Well, and it, as we think about this, with all that we've been through in America, in the world over the last couple of years, I find this Christmas is exceptionally special when we really reflect on our faith, Christmas, what Christ's birth really means to us, to the human race. It's so important, and it's exceptionally special to me this year. We've got just a couple of minutes left, Bill Federer, and we've been talking about your book, There Really is a Santa Claus, History of St. Nicholas and Christmas Holiday Traditions. What would you like to leave with our listeners on this Christmas Eve broadcast?
Well, Christmas Day ended up becoming the most important day in Western civilization. So Clovis, the king of the Franks, leaves his paganism and is baptized on Christmas Day with 3,000 of his soldiers in 496 AD. And so that's when France became Christian. And then you have England, 597 AD, 10,000 Anglo-Saxons are baptized on Christmas Day by a St. Augustine of Canterbury. And then Charlemagne is crowned Holy Roman Emperor on Christmas Day in the year 800 AD. His father was Charles Martel that stopped the invasion. St. Stephen of Hungary is crowned on Christmas Day in the year 1000 AD. And then a Polish king named Mieszko Lambert is crowned on Christmas Day, 1025. William the Conqueror in 1066 AD conquers England, and he's crowned on Christmas Day, 1066. Columbus is shipwrecked on the island of Haiti in 1492. He leaves 40 sailors, and he names the settlement La Navidad, which means the Nativity. George Washington crosses the Delaware River on Christmas Day evening of 1776 and has a surprise capture of the German Hessian troops at Trenton. Captain Cook discovers the Christmas Islands in 1777 there in the Pacific and observes the solar eclipse of the sun. Christmas Eve, 1814, is the Treaty of Ghent that ends the War of 1812. And even Apollo 8 is circling the moon in 1968. And the astronauts Frank Borman, Jim Lovell, William Anders give a live broadcast from the Apollo 8 the capsule. And they give a Christmas greeting. They read the first chapter of the book of Genesis. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And then they close by saying, and from the crew of Apollo 8, we close with good night, good luck, and a Merry Christmas. God bless all of you on the good earth.
Oh, my gosh. Bill, that is absolutely, I just got chills as you said that. I so thank you for this great broadcast, for our Christmas Eve broadcast, and I wish you and your family a very Merry Christmas.
Well, Merry Christmas to all and to all a good night.
Definitely. And our quote for today is Tiny Tim from A Christmas Carol. He says, a Merry Christmas to us all. God bless us, everyone. So my friends, today, be grateful, read great books, think good thoughts, listen to beautiful music, communicate and listen well, live honestly and authentically, strive for high ideals, and like Superman, stand for truth, justice, and the American way. My friends, you are not alone. God bless you, and God bless America, and Merry Christmas. And I don't want no one to cry.